Welcome to Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian Lebeau. This week we conclude our series of special programs on the United States Constitution. The series is based on a project launched by the Bill of Rights Institute titled Founders and the Constitution in Their Own Words, a two-volume collection of materials intended to add to our understanding of the remarkable stories of America's founders. In this program, we focus on the idea of liberty and George Mason. But first, let's look at some items of historical interest in the news you may have missed. Apropos our subject on the U.S. Constitution and the Founding Fathers, as we're all aware, many Americans, when singing the Star-Spangled Banner, can hardly get beyond the first few lines, to say nothing of subsequent verses. Well, the National Anthem Project is intended to change that. Launched on March 10th with a performance of the National Anthem on the West Lawn of the Capitol, and with First Lady Laura Bush serving as honorary chairperson, the project will promote our learning of the lyrics through workshops, in-school programs, and public service announcements geared toward instilling in people the significance of the National Anthem and its role in U.S. history. We want to remind all Americans to cherish our national treasures and to celebrate our unity and our values in song, said John Malman, executive director of the National Association for Music Education. Francis Scott Key wrote the words to the anthem in the War of 1812. On the night of September 13, 1814, Key watched the British Navy attack Fort McHenry near Baltimore. Key expected to find Baltimore under British control the next day. Instead, what he saw was a battered American flag still waving as the sun rose. Inspired by what he saw, he wrote a poem, and the words were later put to a tune composed by John Stafford Smith. In 1931, President Herbert Hoover signed an act making the song the official national anthem. The anthem, incidentally, has four verses. And we recently reported to you the discovery in a Mexican museum of the last flag known to have flown over the Alamo in that historic battle. On the heels of that report, we now learn that one of the 13 surviving copies of the Texas Declaration of Independence has been presented to the Republic of Texas Library at the Alamo. Descendants of Samuel Augustus Maverick, a land baron who was mayor of San Antonio and attended the meeting in 1836 when the Declaration was signed, made the donation to the Daughters of the Republic of Texas. When we return, I'll be speaking with Craig Urish about the Founding Fathers' idea of liberty. This is Talking History.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light, what so proudly we hail at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched, was so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air.
With me this week to conclude our series on the United States Constitution, highlighting a project launched by the Bill of Rights Institute titled Founders and the Constitution, is Craig Urish. Urish authored the essay on liberty for the project. He's a professor of history at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a specialist in the political ideas of the colonial and revolutionary era. Welcome, Craig.
Thank you.
You write that liberty was the central principle of the American Revolution, and that, and I'm quoting again, no ideal was proclaimed more often in the 18th century Anglo-American world. And that sets up your essay really to do two things. First, to show that liberty was the central principle upon which our revolutionary leaders acted, and second, to show that the position they took in respect to liberty was based on at least two centuries of English history. So maybe we can begin by having you first define liberty in 17th and 18th century terms.
Right. Well, I think liberty to English people in the 17th and 18th century meant a couple of things. And I think primarily it meant to be free from arbitrary power, that is free in particular from the right of the English monarch to interfere with the subject's person or property. So it meant to be free to act, to be free to make decisions about your person and property without illegal interference or without extra legal action on the part of the monarch, seizure of property, seizure of person, arbitrary arrest, etc. So it was concerned with person and property and liberty of action protected by law.
Okay, good. I want to come back to that in a moment when I deal with a phrase from Jefferson, but let's get to the second point. You show that this whole idea of liberty came really from several sources over this period of time. And one of the first that you discussed that we may need some explanation on is English common law. What is common law?
Well, common law is a system of law that developed in England over many centuries. And in the 17th century, it sort of crystallizes as not just a legal system, but also a way for English people to understand their government and their constitution. And the argument in the 17th century was that all English people have certain rights at common law. They have these rights because there's been a long historical development. They have these rights because of a customary development of law. And these rights give them protections, again, against the monarch and give them the right to consent to laws that govern them and give them a whole series of legal protections, again, for their liberty. And the rights are common law, or were seen as common law rights.
Okay. You make reference in the book, and you've alluded to it here very often, you use the phrase life, liberty, and property. And so the question often comes up from people who read this, why did Jefferson, to your thinking, change it to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness?
Right. This is, I think, one of the most vexed questions when we're thinking about the Declaration of Independence and about Jefferson's thought in general. The phrase had been used, and if you go back again to the early 17th century, you find English common lawyers writing about life, liberty, and property, always this triad, and Locke, someone who also was very influential on Jefferson, uses life, liberty, and property, or life, liberty, and estate. Jefferson substitutes the pursuit of happiness, and it's not entirely clear why he did this. One possible reason is that he had George Mason's draft for the Virginia Bill of Rights in front of him as he was composing Declaration. Mason used life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. So he used property in the pursuit of happiness. And one argument is that Jefferson, trying to be as elegant and concise as possible, decided to drop property, or to sort of assume that property was really part of the pursuit of happiness, and to sort of drop out property in the interest of a more elegant expression. Other people have argued, of course, that he meant by this to diminish the value of property rights. I think not. There's no evidence that he didn't think property was a natural right, but he may have thought that happiness was a broader call to revolution, a broader sort of sense of what society should be about.
You're right. That second interpretation is often the one that we hear, so it's necessary to look at it in some corrective form. Okay, to look back at our understanding of liberty, you really suggest that in the 17th and 18th century, it was not merely the result of political, philosophical debate. And that very often we dwell on that. What did they think? And why did they use these phrases? What were meant by them? But really forged in the events of the time, and in particular, something that often doesn't appear in the textbooks, civil war, in particular the 17th century English struggles against the Stuart monarchy, which is known as the Glorious Revolution. How did that influence our understanding of liberty?
I think greatly. In fact, I think if you look at this 17th century in England, it's tremendously fascinating, and you really have a conjuncture of a series of upheavals, constitutional battles between Parliament and the Crown, religious disputes that intersect these political and constitutional battles, and out of that you get not only this theory of English common law rights, but you get other sets of ideas, and I think most importantly for the understanding of the Americans, you get this idea natural rights, and this comes out in part of these struggles. So people are trying to think about what the basis of government is, what the basis of political obligation is, what the basis of rights and liberty are in the middle of these rather tumultuous upheavals. And so you get theory sort of coming out of strife and struggle. And in particular, you get a series of ideas that come out of the Glorious Revolution, which is when England actually finally overthrows the last of these Stuart monarchs and institutes really a form of parliamentary government. And this was particularly important. This event was particularly important for Americans in the 18th century. They often referred to the Glorious Revolution as sort of the foundation stone or the cornerstone of the liberty that they then enjoyed, or at least were claiming to enjoy in the 18th century.
Okay, now you've already made the transition to what Americans understood, but let's make it a little more formal here, because by the 18th century, the whole idea of liberty begins to transcend its English setting. It really becomes, and you've made the point in your essay, universalized. How did that happen? Explain it for us.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, I think the central figure here is, again, this English writer, John Locke, who was centrally involved in this struggle against Charles II and then James II. And he writes a little tract in the 1680s called The Second Treatise on Government. And in that, he makes an argument that, in fact, liberty is a natural right, that all of us have an inalienable right to liberty, that in fact we have a right to liberty before there's governments, and in fact we form governments to better protect our liberty. So the government, be it crown or parliament, don't grant us rights or liberty. We in fact create institutions to govern us to better protect our liberty, and then this liberty is in fact something that pertains to all people. And I think this was an important shift. The common law had talked about liberty in universal terms at times, but really it was liberty for English people and for English subjects. Locke takes it, he's not the only one, but he's part of a group of people that really do expand the concept, and they become very influential in the 18th century.
You mentioned, let me pick up on your reference to contract or compact and entering into government. Maybe we just need to take a moment here, because you write, or actually Locke writes, that the best way to protect one's liberty is to enter into a society or to create a form of government whereby one agrees to operate within certain constraints on one's liberty in order to protect one's liberty. Sounds almost like a little bit of doublespeak here, but perhaps you could straighten that out.
Right. Well, Locke argued that what he called the state of nature, that he began his political theory in pre-governmental state. He sort of asked us to think about what would it be like if we didn't have government. And he said, of course, if we didn't have government, we would be in a state of total freedom or total liberty. We would not be free morally to use that liberty to act in a way that would be injurious to other people. So he said there was what he called a law of nature, a moral standard in this state of nature, which limited our ability to act. So what he's really arguing is we just take this moral standard and we create a government to essentially enforce that. So the government is there primarily to protect our rights. So this moral limitation, which existed before government, then is sort of taken over by the government. They get the executive power to sort of decide about what we can and cannot do towards one another. But the idea here is that even though we were in a state of perfect liberty, as he put it, before government, it was too uncertain. We would have disputes and there would be no referee, no judge. So we, in a sense, give up our ability to make certain decisions about our liberty in order to better protect the liberty, to make it more secure. And we do agree also, Locke said, to be bound by the decisions of a majority. Although if that majority, as expressed, say, through a legislature, becomes tyrannical, we can then withdraw. So that's the important part of Locke. We enter into governments, but we can actually then withdraw our consent to those governments if they, in our best judgment, are acting detrimentally towards our rights or our liberties. So it's a contractual understanding of government.
Okay. By the eve of the American Revolution, the colonists, who are still Englishmen really, are grounded then in this long-standing understanding of the idea of liberty, and that soon leads them to rebel against British authority, which they believe is violating their rights as Englishmen. How does this culminate in the Declaration of Independence?
This is interesting because they both talk, and this is what I argue makes the sort of colonial American political theory interesting, is that they really combine these two ideas of English rights and natural rights, and often use them interchangeably. And so they make a basic argument against the British Parliament in the 1760s about this basic right not to be taxed. English common law had always said you should not be taxed without your consent. But as the dispute escalates into the 1770s, you get a series of arguments, I think, which draw much more on Lockean ideas. And they begin to argue that they have a natural right to withdraw their consent to British authority. So they begin to view the whole relationship with Britain, both with the Parliament and then the Crown, as actually a contractual one. And then, of course, ultimately, I think, in the Declaration of Independence, which was not just the work of Jefferson, but was the work really of the Continental Congress, and thus, I think, expresses a widespread view, you have a natural right to resist, right? So they're going to make a claim for a kind of universalism, both of rights and of resistance.
Okay, good. Now, we don't have time to go through all of the state constitutions, but I do want to set this up by suggesting, and many people forget this, that when we achieved our independence, we went through a period of time when we were creating new state constitutions and governments before we went to Philadelphia in 1787 to set up the U.S. Constitution. So we have a period of time in a series of documents. How was the idea of liberty played out with these various documents? And maybe you could give us just a couple of examples.
Yeah, I think that this process of forming state constitutions is incredibly interesting, and I think you're right. It's often not given the attention that it deserves. I think what you get with respect to liberty is you get an attempt to write written constitutions. I think the argument had always been, these Americans start making it, the problem with England in the 17th and 18th centuries had in fact been that the common law was not written, that these rights were not enfranchised in any concrete form, in a written form. So the immediate attempt is made in the various colonies as they become independent states to essentially write constitutions and to therefore better protect liberty and protect rights. And so these constitutions eventually got bills of rights. They often had theoretical preambles. We just spoke about Masons earlier, which sort of talked about what rights people have, often in terms of natural rights. They often protected a whole series of what had been English common law rights to trial by jury and habeas corpus, etc. So they really try to institutionalize this older idea of liberty by protecting it in written constitutions. And I think that's distinctively American. This is something that, again, did not really happen in England. And they also create republican government. So the whole idea is that governments are resting on the consent of the people, which again was an idea that they got in part from Locke. So this popular sovereignty is an important component of these as well.
Okay, well, we only have 1 minute, and it's old news, I understand, but all this talk about liberty brings me back to the inaugural address in January, and everyone did a count of the number of times that President Bush used liberty in his inaugural address. Any brief comment on the appropriateness of that?
Well, in terms of the historical context, I think it's very striking that the kind of language that President Bush uses, you would not have that so embedded, I think, in modern American political consciousness had you not had this 17th and 18th century, and particularly this late 18th century world where I think liberty was talked about constantly, was debated and argued and fought for. And I think that we see that still, we're living with that legacy still, where liberty is really a central value for Americans, and it comes right out of the American Revolution. And indeed, you could argue, too, that this idea of President Bush's that liberty must be, in a sense, exported is also an 18th century idea. People in the Enlightenment argued that we should actually try to spread liberty around the world, that liberty is on the rise. And so I think that understanding the 18th century helps us understand at least an important part of the world we still live in and the political vocabulary and ideas that we still talk about.
Great. And that's where I think we're going to have to leave it. It's a great transition there. Thanks for joining us again. It's always good to talk to you.
Thanks again, Brian.
I've been speaking with Craig Urish, author of the Essay on Liberty for the Founders and the Constitution series and professor of history at the University of California, Los Angeles. This is Talking History. Founders in the Constitution, in their own words, includes 24 units, each dedicated to a specific founder. Our guest this week, Craig Urish, with whom we just spoke, prepared the following brief introduction to George Mason.
George Mason's ideas helped to shape the founding documents of the United States, but few Americans remember him today. Thomas Jefferson, a sometime political opponent, called Mason a man of the first order of greatness. Though he detested politics, Mason believed that it was his duty to protect the rights of his countrymen. He therefore entered public life and took an active role in shaping the governments of his state and nation. He was an eloquent advocate for individual freedom and states' rights. Mason also spoke out against the institution of slavery, though he owned hundreds of slaves who toiled on his Gunston Hall plantation. The author of the Virginia Declaration of Rights and the Virginia Constitution of 1776, Mason's words inspired the Declaration of Independence and the United States Bill of Rights. The Declaration of Rights proclaimed that mankind is, by nature, equally free and independent, and has certain inherent rights, such as the rights to life, liberty, and happiness. It insisted that a majority of the community has the right to reform, alter, or abolish any government that endangers the liberty of the people. Mason was pleased when the United States won its independence, but he was alarmed when many American leaders in the 1780s began calling for a revision of the Articles of Confederation with a view towards strengthening the national government. Mason served as a delegate to the Philadelphia Convention of 1787. He opposed the final document, fearing that the new central government would be too strong and would annihilate totally the state governments. This opposition brought to an end his long friendship with George Washington. It also inspired attacks on his mental powers. One supporter of the Constitution accused him of having lost his wits in his old age. To this, Mason responded, "Sir, when yours fail, nobody will ever discover it." Mason spent the last years of his life fighting to ensure that a list of the people's rights was added to the Constitution. Though the 10 amendments known as the Bill of Rights were eventually approved, Mason was unsatisfied, believing that they failed to protect the people's rights adequately. Faithful to his principles, Mason retired to his plantation a defeated man, choosing not to serve as Virginia's first senator, rather than join a government he feared might be the beginning of the end for liberty in the United States.
You've been listening to Craig Yerish, professor of history at the University of California, Los Angeles. This is Talking History. And finally, following up on Craig Yerish's remarks on George Mason, Fiona Beattie joins us to tell us about a real and virtual site where you can learn more about this particular founding father.
That all men are born equally free and independent and have certain inherent natural rights, among which are the enjoyment of life and liberty with the means of acquiring and possessing property and pursuing happiness and safety. So proclaimed George Mason in the Virginia Declaration of Rights, May 1776, and the words form the welcome on the homepage of the Gunston Hall website. Gunston Hall, the plantation home of George Mason, is now a 550 National Historic Landmark in southern Fairfax County, Virginia. Built between 1755 and 1760, the home is a magnificent example of colonial Georgian architecture, elegant in its simplicity and famous for its unusual and elaborate interior carvings. Cyber visitors can take an online tour of the house, where images and text present an introduction to the design of the house, along with insights into the colonial arrangement of social spaces. For those interested in exploring the history of gardens, a summary of the archaeological findings provides fascinating reading. The website offers lesson plans for grades 3 through 12, a timeline, teacher resources, quotes, and a bibliography. And for those planning to visit in person, the site offers information on educational tours, workshops, library facilities, programs, and seasonal events. To plan your visit and to find out more, go to www.gunstonhall.org.
That brings us to the end of another week of Talking History and to the conclusion of our 8-part series on the U.S. Constitution. If you want to learn more about the founders and the Constitution in their own words, or if you're interested in seeing a valuable collection of related materials, visit the Bill of Rights Institute website at www.billofrightsinstitute.org. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that our producer is Fiona Beattie, that our studio engineer is Alex Smith, and that the opinions offered by our guests on Talking History do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And finally, we invite you to send us your comments on this show by email, if you wish, to talkinghistory@umkc.edu, or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian Laveau.
And the whole